Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, joined by Executive Director of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Jonathan Schanzer, to help me understand ceasefire and not ceasefire. We start in Lebanon. John, a very good evening to you. There's been a major strike, KIA, targeted killing of a Hezbollah senior commander, the senior chief of staff at this point. Strikingly, it was in southern Beirut, none of this border stuff that we've been watching for weeks and weeks. And the Israeli strike was very successful. I see the funeral now, all tricked up in uniforms as if they never suffered a defeat, carrying a coffin with his picture, the usual ceremony. However, is there a ceasefire in Lebanon? And what does it look like? And who's in charge of disarming Hezbollah? As I recall, that's part of the deal. Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. I think the fact remains here is that Israel has carried out somewhere between 600 and 1,000 strikes in Lebanon since the ceasefire was declared last year. Of course, that ceasefire came after the elimination of a number of high-level officials within Hezbollah and the beeper operation, followed by the walkie-talkie operation. In other words, the Israelis made some pretty quick work of Hezbollah's top leadership. The group has been trying to rearm. It did so slowly and perhaps more quietly immediately after their defeat. But that has quickened. And the man who was running the show, the man who was leading the charge to rearm and to regroup, was Ali Tabtabai, the de facto military leader of Hezbollah. Of course, they have a political leader as well, Naim Qassem, but they have taken out, I would argue, the number two within Hezbollah and the number one as it relates to the military elements of this organization. So this was a hugely significant blow that the Israelis struck at Hezbollah. They did so in the heart of Beirut, in the area known as Dahiya, the southern suburbs that Hezbollah is known to control. This was an escalation. The Israelis are now waiting to see whether there is a response from Hezbollah. So far, all quiet. The Iranians saying that there needs to be retribution, of course. But I think we have some big questions right now about how it is that Hezbollah continues to rearm. There, I look at really two primary actors, Iran and Turkey. Iran continues to send those weapons through Syria. That route appears to be open again after months of the Shara government saying that they were going to shut it down. That is not a good sign, nor is it a good sign that the Turks are apparently also placing significant weaponry in Syria. Some of it's being smuggled to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Also, I'm hearing that there may be smuggling routes by way of northern Cyprus, the area that the Turks occupy, and the island just off the coast of Lebanon. So we're watching all of this, very chaotic. We think about that seven-front war that apparently began to subside. It looks like it may be ramping up again.
The Lebanon government, the Lebanese armed forces, let's one at a time. The Lebanon government is supposed to be in position to disarm Hezbollah. They've talked about that to the U.S. representative. Is it false? Is it a failure? Did they try? Who are they that to make promises and not follow through?
Look, you have a president, Joseph Aoun, who's probably one of the better figures that we've seen emerge in this role. But he's still dealing with a dysfunctional government that just simply doesn't have the ability to fight Hezbollah and to do so effectively. You've got a central bank chief that is, by all accounts, a good man. You've got an LAF that I think would like to project power, the Lebanese armed forces, but they just simply can't get their act together, John. And so when I look out right now, I see a government that would love to be able to have a monopoly on force and to be able to control its borders. But the country is so irredeemably corrupt and feckless and bankrupt it is just going to be extremely difficult to rebuild and to do so while also eroding the strength of Hezbollah.
The rearming. If the smuggling route is open, that means Turkey had to approve of the smuggling route open. And what they're smuggling doesn't need to come from Iran anymore. Turkey's got lots of drones. Is Turkey feeding Hezbollah, claiming Iran's doing it?
I don't know if they're claiming it. I think they're just very active in Syria right now. We know this. And they are increasingly leaning on this government to do its bidding. I don't know exactly what is getting through that is Turkish, and I don't know what's getting through that is Iranian. These are the sorts of things that the Israelis have kept quiet for now. But I think it's safe to say that a war of words is absolutely escalating right now between the Israelis and the Turks. They are speaking about each other, not as allies, not as even adversaries, but in many cases, they're speaking of one another as enemies. This is a new development, and I'm watching all of this tension with some trepidation, John. This is a dynamic that was not in existence on October 7th. It has evolved as the Turks have expanded their influence across the Levant. We see them in Gaza. We see them in Lebanon. We see them in Syria. How much further are they looking to push? And how far are they willing to push the Israelis before the Israelis begin to clap back?
Turkey's a member of NATO. Does that have any meaning whatsoever in this circumstance?
Absolutely. The Israelis are reticent to take any action against the Turks. Certainly, they would never do so at home. You know, attacking Syrian or rather Turkish territory would I think be a disaster. And it would absolutely prompt the Turks to invoke Article 5, the self-defense or mutual defense pact among NATO states. The question is whether the Israelis are able and willing to strike Turkish assets inside Syria, undeclared. Turkish assets inside Syria. We hear about MIT, the intelligence services. We hear about the Turkish armed forces and irregular forces. There's a company that I've been following for many years called Sadat that has been apparently training and working with a wide range of terror groups. I believe they also may be in Syria now as well. So the question is, if the Israelis start taking action against any of these assets, what is the response from Turkey? Do they appeal to NATO? Or do they continue to try to operate in the shadows in the gray zone? I don't know.
Gaza, the ceasefire in Gaza. The report in the Wall Street Journal from the editorial board is that a shooter, Hamas shooter, crossed the yellow line and opened fire on Israeli troops. And that this is the eighth time, according to the Wall Street Journal, that's happened. And the U.S. objects to Israel returning fire because it claims it's not proportional. In other words, an airstrike is not proportional to a gunman in the yellow zone. I just give that one example as what the heck kind of ceasefire is this?
It's, as they say, Hamas ceases or Israel ceases and Hamas fires. This appears to be what the ceasefire looks like, at least from the Israeli side of the yellow line. What they did when they eliminated this one terrorist that crossed over is they followed up with a message, which was, we're not putting up with any of this. And the Israelis struck five or six more senior Hamas commanders because, well, they had identified the intelligence and they had identified where these individuals were and they were able to make quick work of it. This is the Israeli way. They save up what they call a target bank. And when they decide to fire, if they are pressed too far, then they usually unload on a number of targets in that bank. The United States understands this very well. There was a moment over the weekend, John, that it looked like Hamas was going to quit the ceasefire. I don't know exactly what happened, but immediately after saying that they were going to leave, another official came back and said, no, no, we're still in it. I think that has a lot to do with pressure that the president of the United States is putting on Hamas's patrons, notably Qatar and Turkey. And so I think things are still moving, crawling along. We hear that there may be the release of another body of a hostage, which would bring the number down to two being held by Hamas. That means that things are still working from the Israeli perspective. But the big question now is, Will Hamas agree to dismantle itself? Will it turn in its weapons? Will it surrender? There is a contingent of Hamas operatives in Cairo right now speaking to the Egyptians, speaking to other negotiators about the prospect of exactly this. I still have a very hard time believing, John, that Hamas is going to just simply turn in its guns and quit the Gaza Strip after everything that they've done. But then again, they have been defeated. I don't think there's any doubt about that. They've lost half of their territory, and they are weaker now militarily than they have ever been.
MBS visited the White House, talking of a two-state solution. Does he ever speak of Hamas?
The Saudis have no love for Hamas. They see Hamas as part of the Muslim Brotherhood, which, as you know, was just there was just action taken by the U.S. government about this. And this was done, I think, in coordination with the Saudis. So they have no love there. They would like to see Hamas defeated. But I think really what they want to see is something else that comes in its place that would be seen as legitimate. That's the big question that everybody's wrestling with right now.
Well, Hamas is not only in Gaza. Hamas is also in the West Bank. Hamas is in Beirut. Hamas is everywhere. The Hamas people pop up now and again. They're in Ankara. So what is that MBS needs to know that Hamas is going to deliberately undermine any effort for two-state solution because it keeps them in the game?
He, of course, knows this, John. What he's actually asking for right now, he's not actually asking for a Palestinian state to be established tomorrow. What he basically said is that there needs to be a road. There needs to be a process in place that will effectively offer Palestinians hope for the future, that they can rebuild. In my view, whatever government they put in Gaza is probably going to be the best chance we have for a government in the West Bank as well. In other words, if we try to just cut and paste the West Bank leadership, the Palestinian Authority leadership, which is corrupt and it's supporting terrorism, and they've got a leader who's 90 years old and he's 20 years into a 4-year term. I mean, this guy, Mahmoud Abbas, is absolutely unfit for leadership. And so there is, I think, we need to be thinking right now about something different, entirely different, while also eroding the strength of Hamas. This is, I think, the way the Saudis are looking at it, and I think it's the right way to look at it.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Shanzer, the executive director of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. We turn to the darkness visible, Syria. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.